Hello, I'm William Miller, and here we are at the end of 2020, and I'm wanting to first wish you a very holy Christmas and a very happy New Year as well. It's been a year that in many ways has been tragic, and in many ways has been remarkable in terms of the opening that seems to be happening about compassion and perhaps even a resurrection of the consciousness that we're all in this thing together, in life together. And with that recognition, I've been asked, and I really appreciate being asked, to share the journey I've been on for the last 38 years, since 1982, when I first came to Satya Sai Baba, in how I've been on this journey that he has helped lead to appreciate, to rediscover, and even to awaken to the beauty and the perennial wisdom of the Christian tradition that I was raised in. So thank you for joining me as I can share my journey in bringing how my own awakening about Jesus and about the Christian wisdom has been fertilized and grown here in my time of knowing Satya Sai Baba. And as my tale unfolds, I'll include the time when my wife Deborah and I lived at the Satya Sai Baba ashram, the Prashanti Nilayam ashram, for 16 years, and how I've ended up now with a refreshing new sense of who Jesus was, what his teachings were about, and what actually his mission was. Now, just a brief history. I was raised as Roman Catholic. In high school, I was the co-president of my Catholic youth organization. I went on to Stanford University, where I stepped away from my Christian tradition, except that I really loved the priest who was in charge of the student center there, Father Duryea. And in my 20s, I moved to exploring Zen Buddhism. I really appreciated some of the teachings that gave me. But it was in my 30s when suddenly I found myself talking about the divine. And I was like, where did those words come from again? And I even remember that was a time, that was around, say, 1982 or so, 1981, when Star Wars, that movie series, had first come out in the late 70s. And I found myself taking some of the themes and saying, bringing words and writing to them, like, divine love expressing through me always draws to me all that I need. And so on. And that's where my spirituality lay until I met a Tibetan Lama named Kalu Rinpoche, who's someone known through a friend of mine. And we went to hear him talk one evening. I remember coming home and saying, I really miss having a spiritual practice. And from those last two things, the sense of divinity starting to fester and grow in me, and the sense of missing a spiritual practice, very soon afterwards, I borrowed a book from this friend called Man of Miracles. It was written by Howard Murfitt, who was an Australian journalist who had actually covered the Nuremberg trials for the Australian press after World War II. And he was writing about Satya Sai Baba. It was my first exposure to who this was. And at first, my whole feeling was, oh, this is really too hard to believe that such a person is walking the earth. But another part of me said, and if it's true, you don't want to miss it. You don't want to look back in 30 or 40 years and say, gee, I woulda, coulda, shoulda, but didn't. And so I actually stopped reading the book at one point and picked up the phone to Pan American Airways, at the time was there, and said, do you know where Bangalore, India is? And they said, sure. I said, well, would you please book me on a flight? I happened to have 2 weeks of vacation due at my place of work, and so I was able to start planning. And 6 weeks later, I was scheduled to leave. But during those 6 weeks, I became more exposed to some of the core teachings of Sai Baba, especially around what his mission was. And I'd like to share those words with you because they gave me great comfort for what I was about to embark on, because I was never a person who was looking for an Indian guru whatsoever. But Sai Baba said, I have come not to disturb or destroy any faith, but to confirm each in his own faith, so that a Christian becomes a better Christian, a Muslim a better Muslim, a Hindu a better Hindu. He said further, I have come to light the lamp of love in your hearts, to see that it shines day by day with added luster. I have come to tell you of this universal unitary faith, the inner self principle, this path of love, the righteousness of love, this duty of love, this obligation of love. And already I was beginning to feel the resonance with what Jesus always taught. The greatest commandments were love. The commandment he gave to us was love. And God's adoration, Baba said, is best done by means of love. This is the message of love that I bring, to foster love, to live in love, to spread love. That is the spiritual exercise which will yield the maximum benefit. And I had that sense that I was moving to a place that was an open space for whatever my spiritual growth happened to be. It wasn't buying into someone's particular belief system, if you will. And so it was in October of 1982 that I flew to India. And I arrived on the last day of Dasara, which is a 10-day festival in India that the last day celebrates the victory of good over evil. And sitting in the Purnachandra auditorium that morning, Sai Baba came around, and part of the ceremony that day was to spread holy water. And being a good Roman Catholic, I knew holy water. I felt right at home there. And he gave a discourse, and I didn't understand the translator, his name is Kasturi, at the time very well. But one thing rang clear and true, and just like a gong inside. Baba said, in essence, when you go deeper inside who you are, you will find that you become closer and closer to God, and that the distance between your will and divine will begins to disappear. Now, I have been raised to believe that God is out there. And I remember in high school, I really felt that if I was to go inside myself, what I would find, as a male especially, was that I was hedonistic, selfish, and environmentally destructive. Those are actually the words that I thought back at 16 years old. So the notion that if I went into myself, I would come closer to God rather than further from God was a blow that broke a stone, that actually start cracking a way of living my life. And I remember struggling to walk out of that auditorium, almost dizzy. And I went to a tree. There happened to be trees nearby at that point, right next to it, and just hung on to that tree for a minute or two just to get stable because something had happened. And so it reminds me actually what I was experiencing, Swami, that was also put into good words. And I'd like to share those with you because there is such a message that I resonated with and that took me on this journey. He said, for courage, you must feel your own importance for your uplift. Never call yourself a sinner born in sin, bred in sin, and engaged in sin. No, that kind of self-condemnation ill becomes a child of God. In every one of you, God is the moving spirit, the very soul. How can you then be evil when you're here to fulfill God's purpose according to his will, his plan, and his law? He has endowed you with many faculties so that you may seek him and reach him. You are not, therefore, a helpless, neglected individual undergoing a sentence of death. You are an embodiment of bliss, born to a rich heritage which is yours for the asking. And that's what started to awaken in me. What is that heritage that I have been born in that's rich already, that I had left behind in some way? And so over the next 19 years from there, I began to make an annual retreat, a retreat to go there and spend some time, because I'd felt my heart open in just the 9 days that I was there. And in fact, ever since I was 13 years old at a Jesuit high school, I'd been on an annual retreat of some sort, 2 or 3 days a year, just to see how is my life going. Did that all the way through high school, through college. In my 20s and early 30s, it was more of human potential movement kinds of exercises, but always a retreat to say, how's my life? And now going to India became that annual ritual for me. And over time, I would take a book with me each time, over one after another. I might stay for 2 weeks, maybe for 3 weeks. And the book could have been the Bhagavad Gita, it could have been the Seven Story Mountain, the autobiography of Thomas Merton, the famous American monk. It could have been St. John of the Cross, who was one of my favorite Christian mystics from the 16th century in Spain, because I became more and more enamored with what the mystics had to say from the Christian tradition, those who had really devoted their lives to living the sense of Jesus' promise that I'm in the Father and you're in me and I'm in you. And what did that actually mean like in life? And in doing so, I remember I'm still working at that point at the Stanford Research Institute in the innovation department, which was my career. And I went to 3M on a visit, a client visit, in which I was to give a presentation. And on the airplane, I had a book in my briefcase about six different Christian mystics. And I also had a book that was brand new by Tom Peters called In Search of Excellence. And I read about half of a chapter of In Search of Excellence, got a little bit bored, and then just devoured the other book, just really read all the way through there. And when I was through with my presentation at 3M, my sponsor there saw these two books in my briefcase and said, oh, what is this one with the faded cover and the cross on the top? And I said I was kind of shy about this. I said very quietly, said, oh, it's a book about six, you know, Christian saints. I like that. He said, well, why exactly are you reading it? What's your purpose? I'm really curious. And I explained to him that what was happening for me was realizing that somehow my spiritual upbringing, my love for creativity and innovation in my work, and the realm of business were somehow facets of the same jewel. They weren't even like separate ideas for me. And that my work was about how to bring those together, in that I was learning more from the Christian mystics than even from the business writers of the day about what that meant to really bring the creativity spirit alive in us from the deepest part of our souls, and to bring that alive in the world of business. And so he said, that is fascinating. Let's go have lunch. And it was one of those many moments where I was very shy to start with and found out that people were resonating all over the place with that. But it brought about the sense of, now, how do you know God? Because Sai Baba said at one point, and it was beautiful around Christmas time, and he told a story about the three wise men, the three Arabian kings, who came to visit at the manger where Jesus was first born. And I'd like to read you the way he described that, which is quite beautiful to what we're about in this journey. He said, when Jesus was born, three Arabian kings came to see him. The first said to Mary, Mary, you've given birth to a child who loves God. The second king said, Mary, you've given birth to a child who will be loved by God. And the third king said, Mother Mary, your child is not different from God. Both are one and the same. And Sai Baba went on to say, the first one's statement indicated Jesus' role as a messenger of God. The second one's statement indicated that he'd be the Son of God. The third statement indicated the child would one day declare, I and my Father are one. Finally, Sai Baba says, these three declarations indicate how one can progress from the human to the divine level. And you must embark on this journey to unity from the divine from now itself. In the beginning, you regard yourself as a mere human being. Then you reach the stage when you realize your potential divinity. And finally, you reach the stage when you realize your divinity. These three stages can be noticed in the career of Jesus. In fact, Jesus, as a messenger, would say, well, I'm only doing what the Father tells me to do. And he talked about, I am the Son of God. In fact, at one point when he was accused of blasphemy for calling himself the Son of Man or the Son of God, he said, but you in your own testament said that God said that you were gods. So what's the problem? And finally, Jesus said, I and the Father are one. And this reminded me of what St. John of the Cross described in the same process, but that of putting logs on a burning fire. He says, when you first put a new log on the fire, it hisses and sizzles and cracks because it's too wet and it's not really primed to be able to originate any flames of itself. But after it gets purified somewhat, all of a sudden some flames begin to start coming out. and it becomes participating somehow in the fire, but it's still dependent on sitting on the hotter coals and the lower flames of the bonfire. But eventually, that log becomes part of the bonfire itself, and it is just simply one in the origin of all the flames and the heat. And so the first was more like the sense of dualism. The log and the fire are separate. But after a while, they become partially merged, since the log becomes a source of flames but still dependent. And finally, they merge. This is much like Sai Baba described these three stages that we're all involved in, that we all can climb through. And the question is, how? How do we move through that journey? This is what enticed me. What could I learn from Jesus about that? Well, you know, one of the mystics that I enjoyed, again, reading was Thomas Merton. And in his book, The Cloud of Unknowing and other places, he said, we don't seek to know about God. We seek to know God beyond the concepts of the mind. There's a beautiful description of this also in a medieval text called The Cloud of Unknowing, which says that God cannot be found by anything that your soul does, but only in the love of your heart. God cannot be known by reason. So, you know, I grew up, I was a pretty mental guy, and I thought my whole identity was in the strength of my intellect. And this was one of those moments where I realized that intellect would not get me anywhere. Because, as someone has said, all the concepts about God are basically limit the unlimitable. And it's only in the direct knowing that you can actually therefore know God and know God, who God is. And Sai Baba talked about it this way. He says, you know, God is love. Love is God. So live in love, live in God. St. Paul wrote in the epistles after when he was spreading Christianity, God is love, and he who abides in love abides in God and God in him. And Jesus himself said, blessed are the pure of heart, for they shall see God. They will know God when they're pure of heart. So it began to kind of coalesce inside of me that the path here, the Christian path, and the path of the perennial wisdom is to develop love in such a way that in love, the knowing of God is automatic. It is because that is God's nature itself. We'd be part and parcel of God's nature. And Sai Baba did a beautiful job of describing what that love is about. What is that nature of that love that we're looking for? And he says, it's like a triangle. On the first hand, it is changeless. It's unconditional. In a sense, you don't turn your love on and off like a faucet, depending on what the other person's up to, or even what you're up to. It's changeless. It is unconditional. He says, second of all, it's selfless. You're not looking for something back. You're just giving. It's just radiating him, perhaps. And the third is that it's fearless, because that kind of changeless, selfless love is so a sense of one with another. Where is there to fear? There is no separate. Nothing separate there. And so, you know, I looked at how Jesus had taught all three aspects of love like that. And where he was teaching much the same thing. He said, for changeless, he said, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you to show that you are the child of the Father who is in heaven, for he makes the sun rise on the wicked and the good and makes the rain fall on the upright and the wrongdoers alike. That is what unconditional love is like. Second of all, about selfless, he said, I am in your midst as one who serves. And whoever wishes to be great among you must be your servant. And finally, fearless. We've all heard this one. No one has greater love than to lay down his own life for his friends. That is where the fearless. In fact, John, one of his beautiful disciples, also wrote, there's no fear in love, but full-grown love turns fear out of doors and expels every trace of terror. He who is afraid has not reached the full maturity of love. And so there we have the sense that the divine love we're talking about is that changeless, selfless, fearless. St. Augustine, who lived in the 5th century, was one of the fathers of the Catholic Church in the early centuries. He wrote it this way: God's nature is love. And by loving God, the human being can ultimately participate in divine love, or therefore participate in God's nature, and also participate in love itself, which is the empowering source of loving one another. And with that, that's where I really, again, fell in love with some of the writings of St. John of the Cross and his companion, St. Teresa of Avila. And John of the Cross wrote a poem called The Spiritual Canticle. He wrote beautiful Spanish poetry. And he wrote this actually while he was in prison at one point. But he wrote it about the marriage between the soul and God. And this mirrored what is found in the Old Testament Song of Songs or the Song of Solomon. And again, I enamored the idea of the soul in the marriage to God goes through these same three stages. There's the original kind of getting betrothed in the first place, then going through the ceremony, and then finally the whole consummation of the marriage. And so I had a ring made, and I had someone lead me through a ceremony of my marriage as a soul to God. It's the ring that I have on this finger right now. And so this is how, again, that whole sense of the Christian tradition was now really nourishing me from the inside out. And this kind of moves me to the next part of my tale, which is my marriage to Deborah. Because one of the things that all of this sense of love talked about is, and you find prevalent in the India tradition, India culture, is that all of this is just an expression of God. Teilhard de Chardin, the paleontologist and Jesuit priest of the 20th century, even said that all of matter is ablaze with divinity. And that sense that it's all really oneness, we're not, even though our senses and our bodies want to create the sense that we're separate beings, energetically and in the divine nature, we are one. And so Deborah and I, before we got married, we realized that the traditional notion of marriage is that the two shall become one. We are two separate beings and we will come together and form a unity. But we said, you know, there is this other way of looking at it, which is that we are oneness expressing as two. We are oneness expressing as this male and female. But the oneness doesn't have to be created, it's already pre-existent. And we have found in our marriage, in fact, that was the whole theme of our marriage ceremony, and we have found in our marriage that that is a chalice that can hold our difficulties. It's a container big enough that we can even celebrate how we're different, rather than having those differences threaten the unity that we might be trying to put together if we felt that we were separate to begin with. And so, this is how our marriage got started. And around that same time, I had a hankering to spend more time than just 2 or 3 weeks at a time going to see Sai Baba. And while Deborah and I went on one trip, it was very soon after our marriage, we stayed for a while, but we were staying inside the ashram. But at that time, a visitor could only stay for a total of 2 months maximum in the ashram, and I was actually hoping to be able to stay more. And so I wanted to have a chance to ask Sai Baba if we could have an apartment inside the ashram. And people are telling you, listen, you know, it's hard. People wait for years and years for that kind of thing, but why not try? And so one day I actually had the opportunity. I had actually done a little fasting for 2 or 3 days ahead of time to get myself prepared. And I said, Swami. He said, yes. I said, can my wife and I have an apartment inside the ashram? And he said, what? I said, can we have an apartment inside the ashram? And he looked at me and smiled, and he said in the clearest English I've ever heard, he said, but this is a mental hospital. And like do you really want to be the inpatients at a mental hospital? And I laughed and I said, yes. And he says, okay. So then he walked away. But literally within about 3 weeks after that, we had the keys and he had granted us an apartment. I know that's unusual, but that's the way it happened. And but, you know, we talked about this as being a mental hospital. It reminds me of the whole notion in Christianity that I grew up with around sin and repentance. And I found out that sin actually was an archer's term. It's a Greek term for missing the mark, missing the target, missing the bullseye. And repent comes from the Latin pense, which means to think. So to repent literally meant to rethink. Repent didn't mean feel guilty. It meant rethink how you missed the mark. And so I realized, well, my life is already like I'm a mental hospital patient. Why not live there? And so I called Deborah, told her the news. She didn't really understand that was a big deal because she was all brand new to all this. But as it turned out, we were able to take an apartment, move in there the next year. That was the year 2000, by the way. And in early 2000, just before we were going to move in, we had a chance for our first interview together. And Sai Baba had us come in to the outer room there. We were in Whitefield in Vrindavan, and a number of other people there. And at one point, he invited us to come back to his private interview room. And he pointed the way, and we walked in, and he walked in right after us. But as he walked in, he looked down at that ring that I showed you a little bit earlier that was about my marriage of my soul with God. And he simply put his hand on the ring and said, marriage ring. And I knew he knew what he was talking about, what I had done. And later in other interviews, one thing that Swami did was to create a Mangala Sutra, a special necklace for Deborah, and had me stand up with him and put it on around her neck. So he clearly was also blessing our marriage, which we're forever grateful for, forever appreciative for. And in our life together, a couple of things happened. One is we took a book that I had since about a year or so called The Christian Mystics, a book about 55 different mystics written by a wonderful writer, Ursula King. And it was the stories of from the very first fathers of the church to the desert fathers to desert mothers and all the way through the 20th century, people had truly had devoted their lives to experiencing this promise that Jesus made about we would sometime come to know that while he's in the Father, he's in us also and we're in him. In that it's really commingled, co-unioned. And what would that be? What is that experience? How do you nurture it? And so we read one story each night and talked about it. And sometimes, well, that's the same thing that Krishna said. That's the same thing that the Buddha said. That's this, wow. It began to see the universality of so many different paths at the same time. Around that time, Deborah's sister-in-law, who was a longtime Christian, asked us curiously, how do the teachings of Sai Baba relate to the teachings of Jesus? And it kind of prompted us to wanting to take a deeper dive into, well, just what did Sai Baba say about Jesus? So we began to look through all these Christmas discourses he'd given over the years, his other teachings, looking at not only what he said about Jesus' life, but also his commentary on a topic similar to the Beatitudes that Jesus taught in the Sermon on the Mount. And so we ended up writing a book which became known as Be Like Jesus. And this came from a quote from Sai Baba that said, try to be like Jesus. Jesus was a person whose only joy was in spreading divine love, offering divine love, receiving divine love, and living on divine love. And so as we were doing this book, we began to discover more about what Jesus' mission could be all about. Well, how do we best understand his life and his identification with the Christ. And we found out, for example, that, as Sai Baba said, Jesus came to teach mankind the greatness of divine love. The highest love makes us aware of the Lord in everyone, as the Lord is equally present in all. And the transforming power of love is boundless. We realize that Jesus was teaching much the same thing. For example, Jesus would say, "I am the light of the world." And then he says in Matthew, "You are the light of the world. Don't let your lights be under the bushel basket. Let them shine." And he even said, "Greater works than mine you're going to do." He also said, "Well, I'm in the Father, but you're in me, and I'm in you." And even in St. Peter, in one of his letters after Jesus had ascended, said, "By following Jesus' teachings on love, we become partakers in the divine nature." So this notion that Jesus' mission was around teaching us that the divine is in everyone. And when he was saying, he was asked what was the greatest commandment, and he said, "Well, love God and love your neighbor as yourself." Not yourself, but as being you. Love your neighbor as being you. And started to bring alive much of that teaching that is like that, those three logs, three stages of the logs in the fire, or the three stages of, you would grow in that awareness of that the Lord is equally present in everyone. And we got a further insight from a book given to us by a faculty member at Santa Clara University, a Catholic university in California. The book was about Henri Le Saux, who was a Benedictine monk who came to India and set up a Christian ashram there. But during his time in India, he began to explore how other traditions could help illuminate the teachings of the Christian faith. And one of those was the notion from Hinduism of Sat Chit Ananda. The nature of God was Sat, which is the being of God, Chit, which is the consciousness of God, Ananda, which is the bliss or life force of God. And that, in that sense, he said that, you know, while Jesus was born 2,000 years ago, the Christ consciousness of God was existent as one of the aspects of God where, even in Genesis, God says, "Let us make man in our image." The plural is in there. And so that sense of Christ as the aspect of the Blessed Trinity came alive. And so as Jesus embodied that Christ consciousness and identified, then he could say, "Before Abraham was, I am." And St. Paul could say, "Christ is in all and is all." So coming back to that same notion that Swami was teaching, that when you become awake spiritually, you begin to see the Lord present in everyone and everything. And Richard Rohr, a Franciscan priest who currently lives in New Mexico, gave us a beautiful way to capsulize this in saying that Jesus' mission was essentially to remind us of the fact that we are already divine, and that his mission was to help us remember and awaken. It wasn't a reconciliation of an angry father who was angry because two people ate an apple off of a tree in between two rivers, and now he had to sacrifice his son in order to reconcile humanity to this angry father. It was a matter of remembrance that God is who we all are, and that we have that spirit in us when we begin to recognize it, and that's what love begins to bring us. And so it brought us back to that notion that, again, we can't understand God with our minds, but we can know God through love, because God is love. But now the question became, how do we live that? How do we bring that alive? How do we bring that spirit and nurture it in ourselves as the path forward? And one thing that was an experience to live through was a lawsuit, in which I was involved in a lawsuit and a counter lawsuit. And it was one of those where I had more than one conversation with Satya Sai Baba directly, just face to face, and he guided into the process that we should be involved in this lawsuit. And that as we proceeded, Deborah and I actually came to a great deal of peace that even though this lawsuit, if we lost, would potentially sacrifice our entire retirement savings, we were at peace with that. We knew it was the right thing to be doing. And that even if we lost it, we said, okay, we're alive, our friends are still here, we'll still have food to eat. You know, what is there to lose other than following what our conscience is telling us to do as well? And guess what? We lost the lawsuit. We lost. And we appealed and lost. And we went to the Supreme Court of Texas and lost. And finally, I had to go to Swami, sitting on the veranda, and saying, Swami, the lawsuit is lost. It's over. And you may know that many times Swami would say to foreigners who were visiting, when are you leaving? So to say, when are you catching your flight home? And he turned to me when I told him about the lawsuit. He says, well, when are you leaving? I said, Swami, we're not leaving. We're here with you. Only later did I realize he was not asking the surface question. He was asking, okay, I directed you through this lawsuit and you lost. Are you going to give up on me now? Are you going to leave me now? Are you going to let go? And I was so happy to find that had never even occurred to us, neither Deborah nor I. But it still left us unsettled because we still had felt that we were right. We were on Dharmic side of this lawsuit. And for a month, it still rattled inside of us in some ways until one day she pulled down a book on her bookshelf. And inside, when she opened it, was a newspaper column that was folded neatly and cut neatly. And she opened it up. It was a column from the newspaper called The Times of India, the third largest, I think, in India. And they, in their editorial page, they always have a column called The Speaking Tree, where people can be writing an article on spirituality to be included there. And I said, no, I don't. I read The Speaking Tree, but I don't cut things out. I certainly don't cut them out that neatly. She had no idea where it came from, so we still have no idea where it came from. But we read it, and here was the gist of the column. That Krishna and Arjuna are walking down a hot, dusty road one day as wandering sadhus. And being very thirsty, they came up to the gate of a rich man's house. And they ring the bell, and the attendant comes and says, what do you want? Well, sir, we're very tired and we're thirsty. Is it possible to have a drink here? And the attendant says, what do you think this is, a poorhouse? Get away. Go on. Don't bother us. And the rich man heard the noise down, and he put his head out of a window and said, what's going on there? And the attendant said, oh, these two beggars are just asking for some handout. And the rich man said, well, send them away, send them away. So they're walking down the road, Krishna and Arjuna, and Krishna says, may the rich man's wealth multiply 10 times. Well, this was kind of confusing to Arjuna, but he didn't say anything. And they've walked further down the road, and then this poor man from a small one-room hut sees them coming, rushes out of his hut, kneels down, touches their feet in reverence, and says, please, I see how you're hot and thirsty you must be. Would you please just come to my humble home? I will go to my cow, get some fresh milk for you to drink, and refresh you. And so they did that. And after they were refreshed, they finally went back on their way. And as they're walking away, Krishna says, may the old man's cow die. Now, at this point, Arjuna couldn't handle it. He says, wait. The rich man throws us out, and you want him to you're blessing him with multiplying his wealth 10 times. The poor man treats us like royalty, and you want his cow to die. I don't get it. And Krishna says, oh, it's very easy. The rich man believes that his wealth is the source of his happiness. And only when it multiplies 10 times will he come to the realization that it is just tinsel. It is not the source of his contentment, his happiness, his deepness in life. And at that point, he'll become enlightened. And for the old man, he has only one last attachment before he reaches nirvana. And when the cow dies, he will reach there. And the moral of the story to us was that God is very efficient in taking care of everyone in these dramas of life. And while in some way he was taking care of us and taking care of our opponent in the lawsuit at the same time, in terms of our spiritual growth, giving us what we need to grow spiritually, which is the true mark and target of life itself. And so that called forth from within us this living of how the changeless and selfless and fearless love is the calling of our divinity. And to be able to be that even in the face of this lawsuit. Now, this led us even further to deepen our own inquiry into our own traditions. And so Deborah and I picked up a way to explore our own history under the ruse and the title of a forthcoming book that we started then, of essays called What Did Jesus Mean by That? And to really start with, Jesus said, if you follow my teachings, you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. The people around him said, well, we're not in bondage. What do you mean set us free? He says, oh, yes, you are in bondage. You're attached to your worldly desires. And how do we, and it just unfolded from there. Well, why aren't we aware of this ourselves? Well, what is the nature of love? What about the nature of eternal life? What is all that? We went on and on into exploration. We got to a certain point when the big thing left for us to address is hell. What did Jesus mean by hell? And we went through two or three iterations of some exploration on that until finally, it's like I would usually write the first draft and Deborah say, yeah, but what did he mean? And we went back and forth a couple of times and finally had to sit down and realize that I had a totally different notion of hell than she did from her Southern Baptist upbringing versus my Catholic one. And we traded notes about what that was like and went back into it again. We ended up having to write six different essays. But what was the notion of it was, first of all, that we went to the chapter in Matthew 25 where Jesus has said that at the end of times there will be a division. On the right hand will be the sheep and the left hand will be the goats. On the right hand, the sheep were those who had served their fellow man, and Jesus said, well, and that was, you were doing what the least of you did with them, you were doing with me. And on the left hand were the goats, and these are the people who had not served their fellow man, and in doing so they were not serving God, and they would go into what was translated in English as everlasting hell, everlasting damnation. But we found in this beginning of this essay that going back to the Greek original language, the two words that were translated as everlasting or eternal damnation was kolosin aionian in Greek. Kolosin was a word for punishment that actually had the notion of chastisement or correction. It wasn't the word, Greek word timoria, which meant vengeance and a return, punishment for vengeance, if you will, a returning of evil for evil. Eye for an eye and tooth for tooth. And so we went further into what that was about. What was Jesus actually saying there? And it led us back into the ancient Greek itself and the early Greek fathers. I'd like to read a couple of things that came, first of all, from Plato. He was writing to Socrates, and he said, he who seeks to punish kolosin with reason does not punish for the sake of the past wrong deed, but for the sake of the future. He punishes, kolatse, for the purpose of deterring the person from future wickedness. And Clement of Alexandria, which is one of the early fathers of the church in the second century, he says, God chastises, kolosin, the disobedient, for chastisement is for the good and advantage of him who is punished. Punishment as vengeance, timoria, is a requital of evil sent for the interests of the avenger. God would not desire to avenge himself on us when he's teaching us to pray for those who persecute us. Well, this was an opening for us to say, okay, what's really up here? And a quote from Satya Sai Baba stepped in here, which is beautiful. He said, the question is often asked, where is God? And the usual answer is, well, he's in heaven. Sai Baba says, not at all. The Lord is in hell. As the denizens of hell are perpetually suffering and calling out to God, the Lord remains there. As among those who seek peace, the Lord dwells. The divine doctor goes to those who are in pain and distress, and God is that doctor. Well, we now felt we were on to something. And our research into the Christian expression of all this led us to a woman named Macrina, Saint Macrina, who was the elder sister and the spiritual advisor to two brothers who became so well known in the Christian church as luminaries, Basil the Great and Gregory of Nyssa. And here is what Macrina said about hell. She wrote, the hell which we've just been speaking of cannot reasonably be thought of as a place so named. Rather, we are told by Scripture about a certain unseen and immaterial situation in which the soul resides. The divine force, God's very love of man, drags that which belongs to him from the ruins of the irrational and material. The process of healing shall be proportioned to the measure of evil in each of us, and when the evil is purged and blotted out, there shall come in each place to each person immortality and life and honor. This was totally turning everything that we had understood about hell on its head. And it brought us back to what is the real thread of essence through all of this. Brought us back to Sai Baba saying, God is love. Love is God. Live in love. Paul saying, Christ is all and in all. Jesus saying, love God with your whole heart, mind, and soul, and love your neighbor as yourself. Sai Baba saying, love all and serve all. We found that love, that divine love, changeless, selfless, fearless love, is the royal road to the three stages of messenger, child of God, and oneness with God. And you know, again, this pandemic we lived through in this last year has had great suffering, but also a great openness to compassion and change in many quarters, and potentially a resurrection of consciousness, a resurrection of this consciousness of unconditional love. And so I conclude here with an appreciation for Jesus, for Satya Sai Baba, and for you, for being with me to the end here. And I'd like to close, since this is Christmas, with the final statements of what Sai Baba has to say about how to actually celebrate Christmas. Sai Baba has said, it's appropriate that the birthday of Jesus, who felt the need to save mankind and who strove to achieve it, is celebrated. But the celebration must take the form of adhering to the teachings, being loyal to the principles, practicing the disciplines, and experiencing the awareness of the divine that he sought to arouse. The day must be dedicated to the purification of one's passions and emotions through meditation on the virtues and values that Jesus held forth. Carols and candles, readings from the Bible, and acting out the incidences that surrounded Jesus' birth are not enough to celebrate the birth of Jesus. Neither is it by festivity and fun that you should celebrate Christmas. Celebrate it rather by resolving and putting into practice at least one of the ideals he enunciated, by endeavoring to reach at least one of the goals that he placed before mankind. Make your hearts pure, your activities holy, and your feelings beneficial to all. As he said, we are truly Christians only when we live according to the teachings of Christ and practice them in daily life. There is love in everyone's heart. Share it with each of 10 persons every day. The seat of truth is in your heart, so the divinity within should be reflected in every action. You must live in love and lead a life of selfless service based on love. Thank you, Sai Ram, and have a holy Christmas.